ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Frustrations continue, a week on from the launch of the new Bureau of Meteorology website.
The Bureau of Met have got fantastic resources that all of us pay for, and they ought to be accountable to their customers, and clearly they need some better management who understand their clients' needs.
And now it's got political, with both the major parties weighing in. I'll bring you the latest on those weather woes shortly. And the dogs that nobody wants.
They're beautiful, gentle dogs.
A rescue service specialising in Rottweilers say they're being left behind. I'm Alex Barwick, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Aranda Country in Mbantua Alice Springs. Words like uninhabitable and survival at stake have been used by Aboriginal leaders across the Northern Territory to describe their deep concern for the future of remote communities. The Territory's four land councils have accused the federal government of failing to consult with them about its proposed environmental legislation reforms introduced to Parliament this week. And it would now seem that non-government senators are also keen to slow the process down. Alice Springs reporter Elsie Lange has the story. Thanks for speaking to Australia Wide.
Thanks for having me.
Why do the land councils say that the survival of their people on country is at stake?
Well, early this week, a joint statement was released from the Central Land Council, Tiwi Land Council, Northern Land Council and Anandiliakwa Land Council, and they say they're dismayed that they have not been consulted about the reform of federal environment laws, despite the NT's immense vulnerability. Acting CEO of the Central Land Council, Dr. Josie Douglas, says Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are already living the impacts of climate change and water insecurity.
Blow to the environment is a savage blow to First Nations people in this country, and I would say to all Australians, because the environment is important to all of us, for our children and grandchildren and future generations.
Dr. Josie Douglas also said the current debate around the federal environment reform had been run as a closed shop between the large environment groups, with little consideration for the unique concerns of First Nations people. And while Ms. Douglas conceded there had been last-minute meetings with government staffers on the bill, that there was not a proper consultation process.
Even though with the referendum result to The Voice didn't go the way we wanted it to go, it does not mean that government can no longer or should no longer listen to the voices of First Nations people in Australia.
Elsie, what can you tell me about this Environmental Protection Reform Bill?
Well, it was introduced to the House of Representatives on Thursday, and its aim is to amend the 25-year-old environmental laws that previous ministers Tanya Plibersek and Susan Lee tried but failed to update. And then today, the Senate delivered a blow to the government's hopes it could pass these laws this year, with an inquiry into the issue being pushed into 2026. Under former Environment Minister Plibersek, these were called the Nature Positive Laws, and they were shelved by Anthony Albanese following fierce resistance from Western Australian interests, including the mining sector. If passed, the new bill will introduce a National Environment Protection Agency and require projects report their carbon emissions, but would also allow the Environment Minister to greenlight projects that don't meet all environmental guidelines on grounds of national interests, which is causing concern to environment groups. The Greens say the bill, in its current form, weakens environmental protection and could mean the fast-tracking of new coal and gas projects and lead to the destruction of forests. Here's Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young when referring the bill to a Senate inquiry that will report back next year.
That the legislation that's been tabled in the House of Representatives today has big business, the miners and the loggers' grubby fingerprints all over it.
Senator Hanson-Young speaking there. Elsie, let's go back to the land councils. What are they pushing for?
They've issued Environment Minister Senator Murray Watt with six proposed amendments, including that NT land councils be consulted on the development of national environmental standards and that Aboriginal cultural values be considered in regional development planning. Other suggested amendments included that land councils could be given more time to consult with traditional owners before establishing development regions and that the minister retain decision-making powers over federal environment projects. They also called on Senator Watt to expand the water trigger to all projects that have a significant impact on ground and surface water, and that projects with major climate impacts be subject to stringent climate risk assessment and decisions.
And so what's been the federal government's response to all of these criticisms, and also what's unfolded in Parliament?
A federal government spokesperson said staff from the minister's office had met with the NLC and CLC to consult on the EPBC reforms and that the consultation was ongoing. They also said the bill will ensure our national environment laws deliver stronger environmental protections, reduce duplication and boost accountability and transparency in decision making. And Senator Watt confirmed there would be no climate trigger written into his government's reforms, but would instead force major projects to report their carbon emissions. Murray Watt gave a press club speech on Thursday and said it was now or never that the bills be passed. But given what we saw happen in the Senate and that the inquiry will push out any decision on the bill, he'll now have to wait until next year.
Thanks so much, Elsie.
Thanks, Alex.
Elsie Lange reporting there from Alice Springs.
ABC Australia Wide.
To the Gold Coast. No matter where you are across the country, rubbish is getting more expensive and there are fewer places to dump it. It's a warning the waste industry has voiced for a decade, but for many councils, the reality is about to hit. On the Gold Coast, rubbish tips will be exhausted within a decade. So the council wants to team up with the private sector to build a $1.6 billion waste to energy project. Gold Coast reporter Dominic Cansdale has been looking into how it works.
It's a pressure felt by many councils across the East Coast. Rubbish tips are filling up and it's getting more expensive to dump waste.
I can see the waste levy going up 3 times, 300%.
Gold Coast Mayor Tom Tate says the city will run out of landfill space within 10 years.
The value of property on the Gold Coast is unaffordable to go and buy land and dig another big hole.
Since 2019, the state government has charged councils for the amount of waste dumped in landfill as an economic incentive to improve recycling. But that levy will cost the Gold Coast $138 million over 5 years. The mayor's proposed solution is waste to energy.
We want to be the master of our destiny as far as handling our rubbish and waste is concerned.
Waste-to-energy incinerators use residual waste, or the rubbish in your red curbside bin, as fuel to heat boilers. That produces steam, which feeds into turbines, generating electricity.
Previous assessments in southeast Queensland have identified that we have somewhere between 1.3 and 1.5 million tonnes of residual waste today.
Grant Gabriel is the director of the Gold Coast's proposed waste-to-energy project. He says the facility would incinerate around half of southeast Queensland's residual waste, generating 65 megawatts a year.
We're building modern, high-tech facilities capable of resolving our residual waste challenges in an environmentally sustainable way, which protects public health.
But Professor Victor Chang from Monash University's Civil and Environmental Engineering Department is concerned about carbon dioxide.
Plastic is one of the biggest enemy toward the whole sustainability. If we burn plastic, we might not only create the CO2, trigger the greenhouse gases issues, but also if we don't burn it completely, it might create certain very harmful chemical like dioxins.
But proponents argue that's a better option than landfill, which emits methane, a potent greenhouse gas that comes from decaying organic materials.
1 kilo of methane is equivalent to 20 to 30 kilograms of CO2. That is how powerful the methane is.
Grant Gabriel says landfill makes up 44% of Gold Coast Council's carbon footprint and that waste to energy would reduce that by more than half.
It's really important that we look at holistically in terms of what would happen if that waste didn't go into that facility and went into a landfill into the ground.
A lack of landfill is a problem that's already played out in the United Kingdom. There, the waste-to-energy sector has grown over the last 3 decades. Half of England's waste is now incinerated, a jump of 130% over 12 years. Of the more than 50 waste-to-energy facilities in the UK now, Sewers Group operates 11.
Landfill is a very easy solution, but it has a long-term legacy cost that people need to understand.
Stuart Hayward-Hyam is Sewers' Chief Technical Development Officer.
You've just done that journey away from landfill. You recognise the need. You're struggling a little bit with the communication to the public about what's necessary to replace landfill. So we've been through that.
UK landfill rates have plunged from 80% to under 10%, but recycling rates have stagnated. As the UK government looks to boost recycling and reduce emissions, Mr. Haywood-Higham says waste-to-energy will reach capacity soon.
So we have old 30-year-old EFWs and we have ones that are new. So if we need to decrease the fleet over time because we're doing better on recycling and we're diverting more waste and we're becoming more circular, then some of those won't get refurbished, they'll get turned off, and we'll turn off some capacity as we go forward, but as they come to the end of their life.
But back on the Gold Coast, around half of all rubbish that could be recycled actually ends up in landfill. Professor Chang says that has to change if waste to energy is to work.
We should take it positively and also cautiously. The plastic should not go to waste to energy. We should try to reduce and reuse, recycle the plastic before we send it to the landfill or send it to the waste to energy.
Dominic Cansdale reporting there from the Gold Coast. We head to Bendigo in regional Victoria next. For many new mums, the weeks after birth can be some of the toughest, and for some, the struggle goes far beyond exhaustion. Parent-infant units provide vital support for women experiencing postnatal mental illness, allowing them to recover without being separated from their babies. But with limited beds and long waiting lists, especially outside the major cities, families are being left without help when they need it most. Bendigo reporter Sarah Lawrence has the story of one mother who turned her own experience into a lifeline for others. And a warning, this story contains details that some listeners may find distressing.
When Monique Orlick's newborn daughter was 4 weeks old, she knew something was not right. But fortunately, her counsellor was able to encourage her to seek further support.
We're struggling with suicidal ideation at home. And intrusive thoughts as well. And they're really distressing. Like, I didn't know what to do with them. I'd never had them before. And so when I was sort of talking to the person at Raphael, she's like, I think, you know, it would be really good for you to go in there, take some time, just try to sort out what's going on. They can help with medications and stuff in hospital, especially quicker than what they can in the community.
She was referred to the Bendigo Health Perinatal Mental Health Unit. The therapist told her staff there could help with medications quickly.
When she first mentioned it, I was terrified. Like, I'd never had an experience in inpatient mental health facilities before, or the public mental health system in general. That was my first experience with it was that time. And I was imagining straight jackets, like shackled to the bed. I was like, what am I walking into? What am I taking my daughter into?
But to Ms. Orlick's surprise, the unit was the opposite of that. She says it was a calm and serene environment where she could stay with her baby and feel supported. After 2 weeks, Ms. Orlick says she thought she was good, but going home was a different story.
After being in like an inpatient facility, it's sort of like a wake-up call. You're like, I wasn't allowed a knife half an hour ago, and now I'm in a kitchen surrounded with cooking utensils. And so it was just all that stuff was so jarring, because it was like, it almost feels like staff couldn't trust me, so how can I trust myself now? Like, it was just this real, like, yeah, just really jarring.
Monique says the second wave of hormones hit and she returned to the unit for another 2 weeks. That was 4 years ago. Now, for the past 3 years, Ms. Orlick has worked as a peer support worker in the parent-infant unit, talking with women going through similar postpartum challenges.
And now it's really cool that I get to sit with that in this work and in this space. Because I remember thinking before I came in here, I just want to talk to someone who's been there and who knows just how scary this is. Because it felt like no one got it. Like, it was like, I'm taking my baby into a psych ward.
Ms. Orlick's experience is representative of the growing need for parent-infant units across the country. Last year, almost 100 parents stayed at Bendigo Health's 5-bed unit for an average of 2 weeks. The Bendigo parent-infant unit is one of 6 public units around Victoria. 3 are in regional Victoria. But in the rest of the country, the services are lagging. No other state has these units in regional areas, while Tasmania, the ACT and Northern Territory don't have any public perinatal mental health units where parents can stay overnight. Megan Galbally is the Victorian representative for the section of perinatal and infant psychiatry at the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists. She says more needs to be done for those outside capital cities.
I think ensuring pathways for people living in rural, regional and remote areas into beds in mother-baby units, into these sorts of services is really critical. Like in Victoria, we're lucky, we have these three regional units. But if I think about the other states, they don't. So even if they have units, they're all in their metropolitan capital city.
Psychiatrists in the Bendigo unit say they are also finding they rarely get referrals to the unit from GPs. While Monique wants to see less red tape and faster pathways for new mums who need mental health support.
I speak about this a fair bit with consumers as well. It can sometimes you're told just reach out for help, like the help's there. And then when you do, like when you make that first appointment with the GP, it's like you're handing over like a part of your identity, being like, hey, like, I don't know, like I'm someone who struggles with like mental illness now, like, can you help me? And then it's just the floodgates get opened and then you're doing like risk assessments and then you get told to call triage or something like that or present to ED and then you do that. And then it's triage and ECAT workers are saying, just call for help if you're struggling, and then you do that, and then it's they'll be like, but what do you want us to do? It's like, I'm just here for the help, like and so it can just feel like a bit of a cycle sometimes.
Bendigo reporter Sarah Lawrence there. And if this story has raised issues for you or anyone you know and you need help, you can contact PANDA, Perinatal Anxiety and Depression Australia, on 1300 726 306 or Lifeline on 13 11 14. It's been just over a week since a now controversial major upgrade to the Bureau of Meteorology's website was launched, drawing an immediate backlash from thousands of Australians who rely on the site every day, especially farmers and those who work on the land. Feedback to the ABC was swift and harsh. Texts came through saying, not happy bomb, bomb site is garbage and not useful anymore. And talkback has been much the same.
I've been using the website for a long time and the new one is a complete disaster.
Well, it's a complete cock-up.
They have reduced functionality on the new site. There's any number of rubbishy commercial sites that could give you the same pretty pictures. But the Bureau's supposed to be a scientific organisation that provides real data.
Bomb meteorologist Michael Logan told ABC Radio in Victoria he thinks people would get used to it. But the federal government has asked the Bureau to fix the site, and Nationals leader David Littleproud has called for a review of the $4 million redesign. Warwick Long presents the Country Hour in Victoria and has been keeping us up to date on this. Warwick, a week on from the major upgrade going live, has there been any change in feeling towards the site?
Not really at all, Alex. The anger remains, right, at the site because it means so much to so many people. So in many ways, this is a recognition of the service the Bureau of Meteorology does for our community, and that so many businesses and people in rural areas that are doing things like fighting emergency bushfires and other emergencies in their community, tradespeople who are deciding when and where they can do work, and people who are sailing deciding on where and when they will sail with up-to-date information, all happens due to the information they get from the bomb. But this redesign has made their lives harder and in some cases impossible. And so that anger remains. In fact, Malcolm Taylor, who runs a business, he's an agronomist, an agricultural research contractor, has been speaking to us this week saying this is a really big deal in the lives of people like him.
Under this new confused new system, we're wasting massive amounts of time trying to get to the information that's relevant to our particular site. It's been designed by IT nerds who've got no understanding of the client's needs.
And so how does that change your day-to-day work and your day-to-day life?
Well, it hasn't because I've switched to another international website that gives me the information I need, which is bloody crazy because the Bureau of Met have got fantastic resources that all of us pay for, and they ought to be accountable to their customers, and clearly they need some better management who understand their clients' needs.
Malcolm Taylor speaking there. Warwick, now the federal government's stepped in. What has Environment Minister Murray Watt had to say?
Yeah, Murray Watt hasn't been speaking much at all about the Bureau of Meteorology website upgrade. All of our attempts to get the minister to speak were met with a deferment, saying it's definitely a matter for the department, not necessarily a matter for the minister. But that changed this week when he released a short statement saying he'd called in the Bureau of Meteorology leadership, the acting CEO, Dr. Peter Stone, asked them to make improvements to the website, talked to them about the anger being felt in the community, and sort of left it at that. After that, Dr. Peter Stone, the acting CEO of the Bureau of Meteorology, released his own statement saying they're not compromising particularly safety when it comes to the Bureau's upgrade, and had an apology of such, but doubling down on what the Bureau is doing and why the Bureau is doing it. I'll read you some of that statement. It's quite lengthy. I'll read you a few lines. It says, and I quote, "I acknowledge the concerns raised by the community and recognise the significance of the change. We didn't make the change lightly, and we appreciate that it will take time for some to adjust. I sincerely apologise for the challenges the change has caused." It then goes on further to go into some of the detail that farmers are angry at, and it says, and I quote, "The new site has been specifically designed to enhance access to public safety information. The Bureau's forecasts and warnings are now more prominent, easily accessible and relevant to your location. There has been significant feedback about the radar on the new website. It's important to note that the website radar provides one view of the current weather situation. It is not intended to replicate or replace the Bureau's weather warnings, which are created by our expert meteorologists and issued ahead of a severe weather event." End quote.
Warwick, National Senator Bridget McKenzie has also weighed in. You spoke to her. What did she have to say?
Yeah, the Nationals want a review, like her leader, David Littleproud, into this website upgrade to find out what had happened here. Bridget McKenzie herself, former Emergency Services Minister, former Agriculture Minister in Australia, and was quite scathing of Murray Watt's performance, even recognising her own failings as a minister, saying she fell on her sword when she was the centre of a case where it was realised the minister wasn't in full control of their portfolio, i.e. the sports rorts scandal for her. She says Murray Watt needs to face up to the same, that this is on a similar level because of the risk to the community.
I would be calling an emergency meeting of not just the bomb, but of emergency service providers, of industries that are directly impacted by a bomb website that isn't working, to find out exactly what they need. It's no good calling the agency head in. The minister needs to hear directly from impacted Australians and then make sure that we either go back to the old website while the new one's being upgraded so that it can actually give people the data they need.
National Senator Bridget McKenzie speaking there. So what can we expect next? Because, of course, the Bureau has invited feedback. Now it's all become a bit political. Is there enough pressure that we might see an upgrade?
So we're already seeing some changes. This is the interesting thing. If you go to the Bureau website today, the new one that is, there have been some changes to the experience. Down the bottom of the page, there are now easier to access links to things like METO, which is some of the wind data, the radars and the satellite viewings. For individual towns and communities, the way the layout is done in terms of giving all the information on one page is still not as simple as it was in the past. So there's still some anger there. But you can see some changes happening in regards to the feedback. But after that statement from the acting CEO of the Bureau of Meteorology, I don't think you're going to see a mass change back to how it was. I think some of the changes, and given what the minister's saying, might come more quickly in terms of the new experience. But I'm not sure that's going to make everyone happy.
Thanks so much, Warwick.
Thank you.
Warwick Long there. He presents the Country Hour in Victoria. You're listening to Australia Wide. My name's Alex Barwick.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
and finally to southern New South Wales. An animal shelter is under mounting pressure over the number of Rottweilers being abandoned and surrendered. Despite numbers rising, Iron Dog Rescue says the New South Wales state government is not keeping up with the demand, and the organisation is calling for more funding for animal rescues and education programs. Rachel Holdsworth has this report.
They're beautiful, gentlemen.
A boisterous and playful 6-year-old Rottweiler. His name is Chico, and he is one of 42 dogs left at this shelter without a home. Hundreds from across Australia end up at Sue Ebert's property each year. Iron Dog Rescue in Bethungra takes in all breeds, but specialises in Rottweilers.
I officially founded Iron Dog Rescue in 2018, mainly so we could rescue more dogs and assist pounds. Throughout the rescue, I realised that Rotties were being left behind primarily. Rottweilers needing rescue, however they weren't making it out of the pounds. And they were a breed that not a lot of other rescues were interested in rescuing either. So having two beautiful Rottweilers of my own at the time, I decided to more specialise in the breed.
Since the COVID pandemic, she was caring for 100 dogs annually, but this year that number has risen to 129. Sue believes a key reason in why we are seeing the large breed in rescues is the lack of education within pet owners.
I think specifically every breed out there is exponential rise in the numbers out there, and Rotties are part of that. A lot of people are breeding Rottweilers, both registered and backyard breeders, and the problem is there's an oversupply of dogs.
Why are Rottweilers so different to, you know, a lot of other dog breeds?
Yes, like a Labrador, for example. They're a very large, powerful dog. That's the main thing. They're incredibly gorgeous as puppies. But they do, like all puppies, grow up very quickly, and they are a large breed dog that requires a lot of commitment, a lot of good nutrition as they're growing, and a lot of training. That's the main thing. Because Rottweilers by nature are a very protective and guarding dog, unfortunately some people don't understand that aspect of the breed. So when that dog comes of age and it begins to show those behaviours of guarding, being protective, not letting tradesmen into the backyard, for example, being reactive towards visitors, then we see people needing to rehome their dogs.
RSPCA Senior Manager of Animal Care, Georgie Casper, says rehoming large dog breeds like Rottweilers can be difficult.
We always have a high proportion of large breed dogs in our shelters, so they're always looking for homes, and those homes are often quite hard to find. So, you know, there's been some research recently actually that suggested that in fact large breed dogs can take twice as long to find a home compared to a small breed dog, and they tend to get not as many inquiries even compared to smaller dogs.
As demand increases, so does operating costs. The rescue relies on donations from pet food companies and community members.
For our average adult dog that's had no previous vet work, we'd be looking at $600 or $700 just to get the vet work done. So that's, you know, full vaccination, heartworm testing as well, which is starting to appear in the region, and desexing. You know, so that's just the veterinary cost. So we don't make money. We don't profit. We are a not-for-profit, and we couldn't make money. We try and fundraise for all the extra costs that we have, particularly with dogs with additional medical needs. I have recently had surgery done on a dog with very severe entropion. That was around $2,000 at least.
But it's not alone when it comes to financial pressures. The Smart Animals Sanctuary and Rehoming Centre, located near Batlow in the Snowy Valleys, has recently been forced to let go 3 staff members.
We've had to cut half of our staff. We've also had to stop taking in cats. The adoptions have dropped off, so we haven't got a lot of money coming in, and it's, you know, it costs a lot to feed and look after everybody here.
Tell us a little bit about the adoptions. I mean, how much has it dropped off by?
Oh, quite a bit. Yeah, it's very hard to get people to adopt at the moment, especially your larger dogs. We've got a dog in there that's been here for a year and a half. It's the financial crisis, I think. You know, with people, they can't get a house that they can rent with a dog. Everybody's struggling. Some people are homeless.
Owner Lorraine Cross says support from the state government is nowhere near where it should be.
With the grants, we've applied for quite a few over the years. We've managed to get one, and that's it. But there's not a lot of grants out there for animals. There is the local government one out at the moment, which I think every rescue has applied for. But yeah, just for animals, we're sort of at the bottom of the list. You put people in it and you know, they go higher in the list.
In a statement to the ABC, a spokesperson for the Minister for Local Government, Ron Honig, says the New South Wales government recently committed $6 million in funding for shelters and rehoming organisations and passed new laws banning puppy farming. The funding will be distributed over 4 years, with $1.5 million available for rescue organisations through a grant each year.
Which sounds like a lot of money, but unfortunately there's a lot of rescues that need help, just like I do, that are struggling to survive, to keep their head above the water.
Both organisations have applied for a grant of up to $100,000 and are holding out hope they'll be successful.
I'm pretty stubborn, so I'll refuse to let this die.
Owner of the Smart Animal Sanctuary and Rehoming Centre, Loreen Cross, ending that report from Rachel Holdsworth. And that's Australia Wide for today. My name's Alex Barwick. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen.